As many of you are aware, this is Sanctity of Human Life Weekend. Well, they call it Sanctity of Life Sunday, but since we worship today, it's Sanctity of Human Life Weekend. Did you also notice that today is the 18th? For those of you who don't know, Hebrew letters have numeric equivalency, and 18 in Hebrew spells the word chai, life. I think it's really cool that today happens to be the 18th. Well, unfortunately, just yesterday, a North Carolina law requiring women seeking an abortion to first have an ultrasound and have a medical provider describe the image to them and offer to let them listen to the heartbeat was ruled unconstitutional by U.S. District Judge Catherine Eagles, nominated to the bench by President Obama. The law, which was originally passed in 2011, didn't require the patient to look at the ultrasound, didn't require the patient to listen to the explanation. But you know, that whole idea reminded me of all the controversy that surrounded Galileo's development of the telescope, which was very controversial. You see, it proved the Copernican theory of a heliocentric planetary system, and also revealed that Jupiter had moons. Well, this flew in the face of some of the naturalist philosophers. It also flew in the face of some Catholic theologians who held to the Aristotelian view, which also was the Ptolemy view, that this was a geocentric universe, that the entire universe revolved around Earth. In a letter to his contemporary, Johannes Kepler, Galileo complained that some of his opponents refused even to look through his telescope and see the evidence for themselves. I suppose when the evidence refutes a position you're determined to defend, you must avert your eyes. This is Sanctity of Human Life Weekend, and the leadership of Congregation Shema Yisrael is unified in our desire to speak out against the evil that is abortion. In case you were wondering, were we going to say anything about it? Oh, yes. At the same time, we want to sound the call to men and women everywhere to repent and receive the forgiveness that God is offering to everyone who will come to him. But let's talk about the abomination that is abortion. On January 22nd, 1973, 41 years ago this week, seven of the nine members of the Supreme Court of the United States, by judicial fiat, wiped away every state law that had previously protected human beings in the womb. They invented a constitutional right that had never existed before. In a bizarre twist on the right to privacy, they legislated elective abortion from the bench. These seven little gods in black robes changed the course of history for the worse. Without a vote of the people, without due legislative process, these unelected men made abortion on demand through all nine months of pregnancy for any reason the law in all 50 states. Seven men legitimized what would become the killing of tens of millions of people. To date, 56 million plus. We call it abortion, but maybe it should be called physician-assisted homicide. Both medical science and our own consciences tell us that the baby growing in the womb is a person, a human being, created in the image of God. And that the only difference between you and me and that baby is time. Now, either I'm mistaken or those judges were mistaken. We are either talking about a human being or we are not. There is no middle ground on this by which we might play it safe. Well, I have two purposes today. The first is to demonstrate that that prenatal baby, whether in embryonic or fetal stage, that baby is our neighbor, a fellow human being, deserving from both medical and a biblical standpoint, our full protection and care. In the process, I hope to dismantle some of the arguments in favor of elective abortion. And my second purpose is to provide you an opportunity to do something about this moral and spiritual crisis. Now let's talk about abortion as an ancient practice. It is nothing new. One of the oldest surviving documents of the early church is called the Didache. It isn't one of the books of the New Covenant, but it is almost universally held to be an authentic apostolic teaching, dated by some as early as A.D. 60. Simply put, the Didache is an instructional handbook for new converts to the faith. It has two major divisions. The first is a code of conduct, and the second is a list and description of some of the rituals of the early church. But please listen to these words from the Didache, chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. And this is the second commandment of the teaching. You shall not commit murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not corrupt boys. You shall not commit fornication. You shall not steal. You shall not deal in magic. You shall do no sorcery. You shall not murder a child by abortion, nor kill that which is born. You know, ancient Rome fell into moral decay long before it fell to the Visigoths. Children were frequently put to death by abortion. Others were allowed to be born only to be left and abandoned at the city garbage dumps to die of exposure. One of the signs of the righteousness of the early church was that believers would frequently go to the garbage dumps and rescue those babies left there and raise them as their own children and bring them up in the faith. How a society deals with its most vulnerable is a litmus test of its morality. But the slaughter of innocent children certainly predates Rome. Pharaoh slaughtered thousands upon thousands of Israeli babies in his quest to keep power. Who do you think was ultimately behind that? Herod slaughtered thousands upon thousands of Israeli babies in his quest to keep power. Who do you think was behind it? The Canaanites, Ammonites, Moabites, all sacrificed their own children in perverse ceremonies, religious rites to Moloch, Chemosh, Ashtoreth, Milcom, their false gods. Who do you think was ultimately behind that? I'll tell you who. You know who. The one who was a murderer from the beginning. The one whose cruelty knows no limits, who is utterly without mercy, pitiless, and ruthless. He is the same one who in ancient times inspired the Amalekites to attack Israel from the rear, targeting and killing the elderly and the very young children, those who were weakest, those who were lagging behind. The most vulnerable of our number, the one who would snuff out the life of innocent and defenseless children, the one whose judgment is prepared from ancient times. And do we want to be in league with that one? I'm afraid that's exactly what we're doing when we look the other way and allow the slaughter of innocent human beings. We end up aligning ourselves with the purposes of Satan by default. And will we not be judged for it? Let's talk about the biological case for the full humanity of the embryo and the fetus. At the very instant of conception, in that moment, that spark, when a female ovum is fertilized by a male sperm, virtually all genetic material and information is fully present in that instant. Not one bit of genetic information will ever be added, and a new human being has come into existence. A unique human being, his or her own unique genetic profile, blood type. Scott Klusendorf, some of you know about him, arguably the premier pro-life apologist in the United States today, says this. Scientifically, few people dispute that individual human life begins at conception. Unlike sperm and ovum, which merely contain human genetic material, the embryo possesses the active or inherent capacity to develop itself into a fetus, infant, child, and adult. It is a distinct, unified, self-integrating human organism. Dr. Landrum Shettles, the first scientist to achieve conception in a test tube, wrote this. Conception not only confers life, it defines life. That is to say, at no point does the distinct organism that has come into being undergo a substance or substantial change or change of nature. It is human and will continue, will remain so. It is an immature human, as is an infant, I would add, as is a toddler and an adolescent. But a human being nonetheless. I believe it is crucial that we argue for the full humanity of the prenatal child at every stage of development. I say this because some well-meaning people have begun to make distinctions between the abortion of, say, a 1 or 2 week old embryo and a second trimester fetus. Now, that argument is premised on this idea of the infliction of pain, which most human beings find morally objectionable. I sympathize with that position, though I disagree. I sympathize with it because I used to argue that way. As long as no physical suffering was inflicted, it didn't seem so wrong to me. But do you know why this is a bad way to argue? Well, first, you're not addressing the core issue, the full humanity of the embryo. But secondly, and perhaps just as important, if abortion is only immoral on the basis of pain inflicted, then sooner or later it will be permissible to put anyone to death so long as we anesthetize them first. While it is true that the embryo or fetus differs from newborns in terms of size, location, and development, these differences don't justify abortion. An embryo may be very small, but since when do rights depend on our size? Men are generally larger than women. Should we argue for fewer rights for women? Shaquille O'Neal is over a foot taller than any of us. He's almost 2 feet taller than Earl Boykins. Should Shaquille O'Neal have more rights than you and me because he is bigger? Those who argue on the basis of development are also wrong. Oh, well, it's not yet developed, so it's not really a human being. Really? A 3-year-old girl is less developed than an adolescent. But no reasonable person would argue that the 3-year-old is less human. What about those who argue on the basis of location? Some argue that it isn't a human being until the baby is outside the womb. And again, I quote Scott Klusendorf, "Where you are has no bearing on who you are. When you rolled over in bed last night, you changed location. Did you stop being you? What about when you moved from the den to the kitchen?" When people say that birth makes the unborn human, my question is simply this. How does a simple change of location from inside the womb to outside the womb change the essential nature of the unborn? Why should anyone accept the fact that a journey of 7 inches down the birth canal changes a non-human tissue mass into a valuable human we ought to protect? Let's talk about the biblical case for the full humanity of the embryo and the fetus. Psalm 139, words that we are all very familiar with. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, Lord, because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before even one of them came to be. Did you notice that the psalmist didn't say, when I was mechanically assembled, or when I was slapped together haphazardly? He declared that we were woven together by God in the hidden places, in our mother's wombs. Have you ever seen a graphic depiction, a representation of DNA strand, or electron microscopy, right? Seeing these phenomenal DNA strands, it really does look like they're woven together. What else does Scripture say about human life? Perhaps the most crucial passage in the Scriptures concerning the full humanity of the unborn child is found in Exodus chapter 21. If men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet there is no injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, and let me just point out that doesn't make a distinction between the woman or the baby. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. Some pro-abortion advocates have argued on the basis of the presumed death of the baby, a miscarriage in Exodus 21. It's a bad translation. And so they argue, well, it's only a financial penalty. That's if there's no injury. And again, no distinction is made between the baby and the mother if there is any injury. The correct understanding that is that if two men are fighting and the wife of one of them is struck and goes into premature labor and gives birth there, if both she and the baby are fine, then there's only to be a monetary compensation, presumably because a baby born prematurely is going to require more intensive care, which means the father, the husband, would probably have to close his shop for several weeks to be right there to take care of things. So a financial penalty. The point is that the baby is accorded the same legal status as the woman. Sadly, many people have been deceived into thinking that, well, if you can't see the baby, it isn't a baby. It's described instead as a product of conception, which is laughable. What else would a woman conceive? A duck-billed platypus? But logic appears to be in short supply these days. Despite the fact that we now have the ability to see a baby growing in his or her mother's womb via ultrasound technology and intrauterine photography, some people still insist it isn't a human being. Well, when is that life a human life? How's this for extreme? Just a few years ago, Senator Barbara Boxer went on record as saying that she doesn't consider a baby a human being until the parents take it home. A lot we could say about the politicians, but let's talk about the wickedness and avarice of the abortion quote-unquote doctors. I put quotes around that because a physician's oath begins with the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm. So that's why I put quotes around it. Deuteronomy 27:25, cursed is the man who accepts a bribe to kill an innocent person. Can this be applied to a doctor who performs abortions? Well, let's consider the context and see. In Deuteronomy 27, we find the nation of Israel at the threshold of Eretz Canaan, the promised land. Before entering, however, God commanded that once we cross the Jordan, we were to gather at the mountains Gerizim and Ebal, Six tribes were to stand on each mountain facing each other. Those on Gerizim were to pronounce the blessings for obedience, and those on Ebal to represent the curses of disobedience. At that time, the Levites were told to pronounce specific curses, 12 in all, ranging from idolatry to incest to perverting the judicial process to real estate fraud to bestiality. But the 11th of these curses reads as follows: cursed is the man who accepts a bribe to kill an innocent person. Anyone who agrees to murder an innocent person in exchange for a sum of money, i.e. a hitman, is cursed. The three key words are bribe, innocent, and person. A bribe means the person's being paid for their nefarious services. Now, in order for this not to be applicable to an abortionist, you would have to prove one of two things: either that the unborn baby is guilty of a specific crime, and in order to prove guilt in a capital case, you'd have to produce two or three witnesses. How are you going to get witnesses into the woman's uterus? Or else you would have to prove that the unborn baby is not a person. But as we said, some people do argue that way. A century and a half ago, slave owners argued that black people were less than human in order to justify enslaving them. It was inhuman. It was terrible. But they would argue that, hey, they're not quite human. 70 years ago, the Nazis, hoping to create a master race and citing the claims of eugenics, argued that Jews were less than human in order to justify exterminating them. Those who today argue that the unborn babies are not human beings are employing the same rationalizations. Now, no one comes out of an abortion mill a winner. But for the abortionist, silence is golden. When you consider that at an average fee of $400 per abortion, and that is conservative. At an average of $400 fee per abortion, at an average of 10 to 20 abortions per day, the abortionist, he or she, nets after expenses somewhere between $1.5 and $3 million annually. Cursed is the man who accepts a bribe to kill an innocent person. Can you think of a more apt description of what abortion is? The abortionist is accepting money to murder an innocent person. Please don't deceive yourselves into thinking that they got into this industry because they really care and they're all about helping teenage girls who would otherwise have to become mothers before they're ready. This is no humanitarian endeavor. This is a multi-billion dollar industry. And it's made millionaires out of those who once upon a time swore the Hippocratic Oath: first, do no harm. You might wonder how they can live with themselves. How can someone who does this kind of thing sleep at night? Well, Hermann Gosnell apparently could. Remember about him? A year and a half ago, indicted for actually killing babies that had been born. And the whole country was just horrified. Horrified. How inhuman. Substantially, it's no different than killing the baby who's just right there, 7 inches further up. Apparently, he could sleep with himself. The abortionist, how can anyone justify this? Well, the answer is disturbing, because they actually do. As a matter of fact, let me digress for a moment and tell you what slave owners and abortionists and the Nazis all have in common in order to rationalize their slaughter. They told themselves and their critics that their victims were not, after all, entirely human. Those of conscience in the 17th and 18th centuries didn't buy the lie of the slave traders. They protested. They protested on the streets. They protested in the churches from the pulpits. They pleaded with their nation, put a stop to this evil slave trade. Those of conscience in the 1930s and 40s didn't buy the lie of eugenics or of Nazism or of National Socialism. And those of conscience today aren't buying the lie of the abortion industry. That life is human, and it is precious, and it deserves our protection. If you want to be equipped to answer the arguments of abortion advocates, let me recommend a fantastic article, and as always, the sermon will be available online. It's an article written by Scott Klusendorf entitled, Five Bad Ways to Argue About Abortion. And you can actually get it at standtoreason.org. But let me conclude. Hear the words of Isaiah the prophet. Seek justice. Reprove the ruthless. Defend the orphan. Plead for the widow. And consider the words of the psalmist. Blessed is he who has regard for the weak. The Lord delivers him in times of trouble. And of course, this goes along with the teaching of Yeshua, who said, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Those who are willing to be inconvenienced and even risk their own safety and well-being for the sake of the defenseless and weak will receive the very same regard from God. You know who my heroes today are? Shifra and Puah, the Jewish midwives, who stood up to the king of Egypt and defied him. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. This theme reverberates throughout the scriptures. There have always been those in every society who are weak and vulnerable. And there have always been in every society ruthless opportunists lying in wait to profit from it. We are not to stand idly by and let it happen. The psalmist charges us with their defense and rescue. Now remember, these words were not written for the world at large. These words were written for us. It's an in-house memo, my friends. I don't expect the heathen to take up the cause of the weak and the defenseless, but you and I are most definitely called to speak out for them. Toward the end of World War II, after Germany was delivered from the clutches of the Nazis, and when the scope of the horror and the atrocities committed against the Jewish people became apparent and were broadcast around the world, many German people said they didn't know it was happening. Never mind the systematic extermination of the Jewish people had already been going on for years. The smoke ascending from the Nazi ovens that you could see from miles away. Never mind the train boxcars filled with crying human beings crossing through the German countryside. And of course, there was a lot of talk, but many Germans pled ignorance. As though anticipating just such excuse-making, the author, the writer of Proverbs said this, rescue those being led away to death. Hold back those who are staggering toward slaughter. If you say, but we knew nothing about this. Does not he who weighs the heart perceive it? Does not he who guards your life know it? And will he not repay each person according to what he has done? I'm convinced that we will be held accountable if we remain silent in the face of the systematic slaughter of millions of our most defenseless neighbors, the unborn. And they are our neighbors. They are the most vulnerable members of the human family, and they are unable to speak in their own defense. Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, for the rights of all who are destitute. Speak up and judge fairly. Defend the rights of the poor and the afflicted. You know, some of the change that eventually brought about the abolition of slavery was achieved from the pulpits and from the street corners. Street preaching, appealing to people's consciences. But for others, it took a war. Even afterwards, some change had to be made through the legal system. See, that's the difficult thing. Some people learn through conscience, while others have to have morality legislated in order to not do the wrong thing. Understand then that the present evil we are confronting needs to be fought on several levels. We need to appeal to the conscience of men and women that human life is created in the image of God and is sacred. That's what we're doing here this morning. And that's what's being done by all too few faithful who are counseling young women on the sidewalks outside the abortion mills, pleading with them to choose life for their babies. We also have the opportunity to volunteer our time and energy at local crisis pregnancy centers. And we also need to use our marvelous legal system with which this country was endowed, which has been perverted by those with a hideous agenda. Our voices of moral protest need to be heard by those who claim to represent us in government. Before we conclude, let me say something very important here. In any gathering of this size, there are likely to be some who have had an abortion, or who condoned an abortion, or participated in some way. I'm one who's guilty of having condoned. Please hear this. There is forgiveness. There is forgiveness because of the sacrifice of Messiah Yeshua. There is forgiveness and cleansing and healing when we openly confess our sins to God. Guilt is a God-given thing. It can serve to bring us to repentance so that we live. There's so much more that could be said. Let me just conclude with these words from the Torah as our calling. Tzedek, tzedek, justice, and only justice shall you pursue in order that you may live and possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you. We're going to continue in prayer, praying that we and our nation might turn to life.